Good morning. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director and CEO of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and it's the MMA's pleasure to host weekly briefings by Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito on behalf of the Baker Polito Administration to provide updates on COVID-19 to all of the municipal chief executive officers here in Massachusetts. In a second, we'll start this program with the Lieutenant Governor giving an overview. But first, on behalf of the MMA, we want to express our appreciation to the Lieutenant Governor and to the Governor for the leadership and the partnership with cities and towns, not just during the COVID-19 crisis, but also in recent days following the death of George Floyd and the tragic result and the racial division in this nation and the peaceful protests, but also violence. The partnership between state government and local government has never been more important. And the words of the governor and the lieutenant governor supporting justice and supporting local officials and all people searching for reconciliation are critically important right now. I did want to call all local officials' attention to the National League of Cities, a race, equity, and leadership program. You can access information on how to have dialogue, discussion, and racial reconciliation and justice conversations in your communities by going to nlc.org and leaning in and participating in that program. Many of you at our annual meeting in January saw a preview of the powerful effects and dialogue that can happen with the NLC's REAL program. And the time is right now for you to be able to access that resource. So nlc.org, race, equity, and leadership. This is a critically important time, and the MMA is here for you. We know that the administration is here for you, and we know that you are there for all of your citizens during this time. So we want to say thank you to the local officials who are providing leadership, but also, of course, to Lieutenant Governor who's here today, who will talk about COVID-19 and the entry into phase two and all the tools and resources being provided for cities and towns. But also just about the leadership that that she and the administration is providing. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, good morning. Thank you, Jeff, and to your team for opening this morning, and your words are so appropriate. I think everyone is struggling. It's a hard time, it's a tense time. And then, of course, the circumstances surrounding the death of George Floyd are just heart-wrenching for all of us. And we know here in this Commonwealth, we don't tolerate racism and injustice, and we support equality and tolerance and peaceful displays of what we believe are the ideals that guide us and help us move forward. And as we monitor what's happening in our communities, we obviously support the peaceful protests and demonstrations. And we can see some beautiful displays that people have been organizing with children and families and people coming together. But then, you know, late in the night or early in the morning, there's been some activity that has been destructive, and it puts both people, personal property, as well as our officers in front line in the middle of some very, very difficult circumstances. So we keep them in our thoughts and prayers too, as they monitor and support the peaceful activism, but also the criminal actions that can be very destructive and really set back what these displays are supposed to be about. So getting back to the response in recovery and reopening, which is a really good thing to be talking about as we prepare for phase two. We have with us Commissioner Sam, who's done an extraordinary job, her whole team, in preparing the long-awaited child care guidelines, as well as summer camp program guidelines that can also help municipal programming. She'll go through that with you. You also asked for Dr. Catherine Brown to come in and talk about how what you and we are calculating positive COVID-19 cases and what that means and how we monitor the virus and how that can be a tool and asset as we move forward. As always, we have our DLS Deputy Commissioner Sean Cronin, Department of Labor Standards Michael Flanagan. We have Sean Pierce from EEA and Tom Mangan from the Command Center, all on to assist with addressing any questions that you have during the course of our time together. So before getting to Commissioner Sam, I just want to go over and thank you for distributing to the members the industry protocols for phase two. Yesterday, in particular, you released the restaurant and lodging and yesterday retail industry protocols, but we also issued an executive order that describes more specifically what businesses and sectors are included in phase two, three, and four. And that full list, and it's a good amount of detail in it, is on the website. So if you don't have it, go look for it, and it will be a very good guide for you as municipal leaders to see where things fit. As we prepare for these businesses opening in phase two, we wanted to give them a chance, these business owners, to get into their workplaces, bring in some employees to start preparing their workplaces. The whole goal here, working with municipal officials, is to see the mandatory safety standards incorporated into workplaces and organizations. We want to make them safer for workers as well as customers and the public visiting these places. So compliance is really important in giving them a little bit of time through the actions of the governor's executive order yesterday will help them get ready. I can list down some of the ones that will be advanced early on in phase two. So as you know, on June 6th, after we look at this week's data, the governor and our team will evaluate the data. And hopefully, it continues to trend downward, as we all see in the daily numbers. And we'll be able to identify a date next week for the beginning of phase two. So retail with restrictions, public libraries, that guidance is coming to you for public libraries. Driving schools and flight schools. A lot of young drivers out there are anxious to get those driver's licenses. I'm a mother of a 16-year-old, I know that. Personal services that do not include close contact will be the early phase of phase two, so like photography, window washing, career coaching, so there's some distance between the individuals. The other personal services will be later on in phase two, like massage, nails, and those sorts of things. Funeral homes will be permitted to have a wake service with a capacity limit. Warehouse and distribution, as you know, lodging, including all hotels, motels, inns, beds and breakfast, and short-term rentals. Restaurants, outdoor dining, we gave you extensive guidance there, not only for the business, but also allowing for the outdoor dining in places that are maybe contiguous to the restaurant, but also remote from the restaurant, and giving you the tools to work with and be as creative as you can to work with restaurants to incorporate more outdoor dining into your downtowns and main streets and just into your community. So there's a lot there. You should study that pretty carefully. Outdoor recreation activities such as pools, playgrounds, mini golf, batting cages, golf facilities, including driving ranges, and limited organized youth and adult amateur sports activities and programs, and recreational day camps. That guidance for youth sports will be coming out, could be today or tomorrow. I also said that this will be a staggered phasing in of some of these activities in phase two. So for instance, indoor dining will be later in phase two. We'd like to see how outdoor dining goes, watch the numbers, and then activate indoor service, as well as some of those closer contact personal services. Retail, we also issued a guidance order there that will allow in-store browsing and opportunities to go inside the establishments. And there are both square footage or percent in terms of occupancy that a retail establishment can operate under. There are a number of items on that guidance. I don't want to go into those right now. I touched upon restaurants. I think you are all familiar with what we're doing there in terms of 6 foot distances, party sizes at a table of six, no standing or bar service is too close a contact, and a shared surface is discouraged by the public health team. And there are other parts of the protocol, like not pre-setting tables, restaurant reservations encouraged, that could assist with contact tracing, et cetera. Lodging, there is an urged self-quarantine for 14 days for out-of-state travelers. It's urged. Hotel operators must tell the person making the reservation that it's urged, and it can be done in a self-compliant manner. But the hotel industry can start taking reservations for their establishments. Let me just close with the child care. And again, as you know, when we started the reopening advisory board process, some key enablers for employers are transportation as well as child care. And you can imagine, and the commissioner will talk more about this, but child care is going to look different than it did before COVID. Obviously, it's a different model. It took a lot of research and analysis to come up with a program that makes sense for the children, for the workforce, as well as the families that depend on this service when placing their child into the care of others, especially in this environment. So we're very grateful for their work here, and I want to give the commissioner an opportunity to kind of walk through what that guidance looks like and then address questions from the members.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here today. I, as Lieutenant Governor referenced, we have a number of really critical components of what we've rolled out that I wanted to go over. But as a former preschool teacher and child development person, I have to just echo what the Lieutenant Governor said, is that this is a hard time, and childcare is going to look different than we traditionally have seen it. And you know, as a teacher, that is a hard thing to take. And I think I just want to empathize with all of the childcare constituents you may all be hearing from, that this is a different reality. And I can imagine how hard it would be to be in the classroom at this moment. So I wanted to take a second and talk a little bit about what our guidance requirements for childcare and summer camps look like. I walk you through a couple of the components of that, and then talk a little bit about the process that we will be going as we work through phase two, work towards phase two, and what we will be doing to make sure we can expedite the opening, but also ensure that you all can be confident in the oversight that we are providing, so that your families can access childcare safely and comfortably. And then I'm happy to answer any questions that people have, and know that many of these are questions we didn't know were questions a few months ago, so we are answering them as quickly as possible, and know that the reality on the ground is really helping inform our decisions going forward. As Lieutenant Governor mentioned, we are marching towards providing the resources for providers to prepare for reopening in phase two. So the guidance provided yesterday outlines both ratios and group size for different age groupings that I will walk through, as well as the operational procedures that our programs will have to abide by in order to ensure that we are stemming the spread of the virus and monitoring and making sure that childcare programs don't become exposure sites as we move forward. We will still be running our emergency childcare program, and as we phase that out, we will ensure that there is enough transition time, that there is not gap between programs reopening and the emergency childcare closing, as best to our ability. But if you know in your community there's any challenges with that, we've been proactively reaching out to people to help us fill those gaps, so please don't hesitate to let us know, and we'll make sure that we can be a support to the families in your community as well. The guidance that was released, as I said, does go over ratios and group sizes for the different age groupings. You'll see in there that our infant and toddler ratios and group sizes have remained the same from pre-COVID levels. In looking at the public health research, the evolving emerging data on impact with children and understanding the operations as other states have opened up, we felt confident that that was something that programs abiding by the right operational procedures could keep safe. Preschool does cut the group size in half. That is, preschool traditionally has had a group size of closer to 20 to 24. In this consideration, we are limiting that to 10 children with two adults, but we are encouraging people to think about space differently, to be able to split space, add different groupings, and while that minimum group size or maximum group size does abide by the best public health information, and anyone who's ever been a preschool teacher knows that keeping 23-year-olds doing anything is difficult, let alone social distancing and not climbing on each other. And so we're hopeful that the group size of 10 helps maintain some control over those standards in the classroom. That said, the biggest impact, I think, to our providers going forward, there isn't much of a change also in the school age group size for camps or for after school or out of school time programs that your communities may be implementing. The biggest change across all of this is some of the operational procedures around keeping cohorts together, no intermingling between groups, shared spaces have to be limited, non-essential adults in the building have to be limited, drop-off and pickup screenings have to be done. Those are operational considerations beyond group size and ratio that really have to be in place, as Lieutenant Governor referenced, across all industries to make sure that we are really abiding by the best public health information. And we know that that will take some planning and some forethought and some staffing considerations for our childcare agencies and our camps. And so releasing these requirements now prior to phase two is really hopefully done so that people can start to look at that and understand their program configuration before having the full process to start a reopening. We know that this is a hard shift, and as we head towards phase two, we want people to be as prepared as possible to meet those the new obligations of being able to keep families, children, and their staff safe during this time. And so as we've looked at that, you have those requirements. They are we are constantly answering questions. As we knew on this, there were clarifying points that people would have, and with 8,000 different childcare agencies, both 6,000 family childcare homes and over 2,000 childcare centers across the state that are all configured differently. We've done our best to set the minimum requirements, but know people have questions around how that applies to their specific space and are answering those as quickly as possible, and providing updated FAQs to try to keep providing that clarity. So do encourage people to reach out. As we look through that over the next, as we head towards phase two, as Lieutenant Governor referenced, the administration will be looking at the data and making decisions about timing. What people can expect as they look forward, childcare centers in particular can expect as they look forward to reopen, is a process where they will submit a plan and a self-attestation to EEC to be able to reopen. We will make this as efficient and as seamless a process as possible and rely on their expertise at the local level to be able to assure that they are meeting these requirements. We want you and we want our families to be assured that we have done our due diligence to ensure that they have a plan in place to meet these requirements, but we will not require site visits or any sort of time delay so that we can get childcare up and running as quickly as possible to meet the needs of your families and your communities. So we will be releasing templates and information on that in the upcoming days and heading into phase two, and then be prepared to launch when the administration does deem that the data is safe to launch towards phase two. We will be launching that process so that people can submit those plans to us and make sure that we are efficiently turning them around and allowing them to open as quickly as possible. Please know that this also will mean for the as we head towards the new normal that we are adjusting all of our processes too. So our work going forward in terms of monitoring will look different, and we will be working with our childcare centers to make sure that we are supporting them in implementing a very different programming for the foreseeable future. That said, we also know that this summer will be a summer of transition, both programs deciding whether they can come back to the market over the summer or are waiting for the fall, and parents also deciding what services they need as work changes, people are working from home more, staggered schedules, and so we know that that is the case. So we'll be monitoring the information and data carefully, both before opening in terms of intent to reopen and being able to understand where we may have gaps across the state over the summer and be able to work with you all to figure out how we best make sure there are services for your families and in the meantime. But also know that this will be used to inform what will inevitably be some shifts and some reconsiderations of decisions as we go towards the fall, knowing that we'll be also not only looking at the public health landscape and that evolution, but also public school landscape and what families may need from the childcare market when we look towards a shift in the overall landscape in the fall. So with that, let me clarify one component and make sure that I was crystal clear on this. CAMHS as well will meet these requirements. Obviously, the regulatory process is different with CAMHS. The Department of Public Health does set forward the regulations as well as and then help support the local boards of health in implementing and overseeing the CAMHS. And so they're working with the local boards of health to make sure they understand and have the information they need on these regulations. But CAMHS will have a different process to reopen because they're not overseen by the same entity. So they will report to the local boards of health on that. But the guidance is aligned because we know that your programs may be operating multiple types of programs. Your families may be utilizing CAMHS and childcare. And we wanted to make sure as much as humanly possible, we weren't creating any false bifurcations at the community level or one child has to follow one rules and the other another. So making it as consistent as possible for your families and your communities while abiding by the oversight authority that each agency has. With that, I'm happy to answer questions. Our Lieutenant Governor, if there are any questions that you think I hadn't addressed proactively, happy to fill in any gaps.
Lieutenant Governor, I do see a few questions that are related right to the Commissioner's presentation. So I will go right to those, if that makes sense.
Yes, please.
And then we can double back to other questions as well. So a couple, is there specific guidance for childcare facilities that share buildings with other groups and activities? Thinking about a childcare center in a church, for example, and have other programming.
Yeah, they would need to look at the operational procedures that we have laid out, and that is particularly why we're asking for a plan. We know that those specific site considerations have to be taken into account, how you clean, how you make sure that there's no contact between different groups. And so while we don't have specific guidance on every program configuration, we are hopeful that by putting forth the minimum requirements and then templates for plans, that helps people walk through what they would need to do in their specific situation to abide by what kind of other space utilization happens in their childcare center.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then here's another question. The guidelines indicate that at day camps, campers must stay 6 feet away from others all day, every day, indoors or outdoors. Seems almost impossible for younger campers. So we're not sure, this municipality is not sure they're going to be able to run their camps this summer. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is that an accurate interpretation of the requirement?
Yes. So I think we understand that children are, and I would say not only younger children, I am an early childhood child development person, but I think my experience with teenagers is that also can be true for teenagers. And pre-adolescent. And so I think that we understand that this will be really difficult. We're very careful to put encourage and support, but obviously we will be providing videos and trainings on how you can encourage these practices, but we don't want you to be punitive to children and and in any way, you know, force or we understand this is hard, but we also know that as much as possible, designing activities that really do encourage social distancing as opposed to close contact are some of the guidance that we'll continue to answer questions on, and what we hope that the professionals, both in camps and in childcare, can really help use their expertise to design the day in ways that encourage those kind of behaviors. Although we recognize that it is hard to require children not to touch, we want to make sure that our activities are designed to encourage it.
Right. Thank you. If I'm sure, as you mentioned, that there are so many questions coming in, what's the best way? And we will, of course, include this information on our website and push it and continue to push it out to the membership as best we can as well. But what's the best way for local officials who have questions in particular about their own programs, or they're looking for some clarity to seek that clarity? What's the best way?
So if it's about the regulations or the requirements specifically, there's a link on our website where you can submit questions, and we're aggregating those to, for regular updates to the FAQs, or can answer them individually if there's a specific situation. Otherwise, I think in terms of if it's about a specific program in your community, or if it's a specific specific camp, you know, happy to answer those. I would suggest that the program specifically should ask their main contact. You know, a licensor can aggregate. We have a process internally to aggregate those questions. But if it's a municipality, happy to have them collected and come to me directly, and we can make sure that they get answered effectively and efficiently.
Okay, thank you. I'm looking for further questions regarding your. It's just there's so much. It's so complicated, and they came out yesterday. I do notice a comment in the chat asking for this material in advance. Essentially, the material is available in real time and is just really unfolding itself throughout Massachusetts. We applaud you for all of your work. This is multi-departmental and disciplinary, and we know that there will be ongoing questions, and we'll be able to, we'll encourage our members to contact you, and we will also be contacting you. I'm scrolling. I don't see any more specific questions regarding summer camps and childcare. So right now, Commissioner, and I'm going to try this. Agner Treewarji, is that correct, Commissioner?
It is. Yes. I will say I do actually, being a former preschool teacher, and I do actually go by Commissioner Sam, so it is, it fits me very well.
Well, that's great. It's a lot easier, but I had not considered myself on a first name basis until now, but we'll take advantage of that.
Thank you so much. And thank you. Happy to continue answering questions. We know it's a lot. We know this is a big shift across every industry, and childcare is certainly no difference, and camps. And so please do keep them coming. And we're learning as quickly as everyone else and working to provide the guidance and support along with our other departments. So happy to do so as they come up.
There is a question from Mayor of Gloucester, Head Start programs.
Yep. So Head Start programs are directly funded from the federal government and has received funding, but also are licensed by EEC. And so they will have the same process, but will be able to work with the federal government to decide whether they are opening up or not under their own their guidance directly from HHS.
Okay. I'd like to also just note in phase two, the activation of pools, spray decks, you know, those kinds of activities which would be complementary to a summer day camp program. So that is also as part of phase two. So for the municipal officials, when you're thinking about the kinds of activities that can work, there are a couple more examples.
And we know, Lieutenant Governor, that guidance will be coming out as shortly for the pools and the playgrounds. So
yes,
we appreciate that very much. I also noticed that, Lieutenant Governor, we have Dr. Catherine Brown from DPH on, who could potentially talk a little bit about the new method of monitoring and reporting on cases on a municipal basis. And that might be an important update for communities to receive, and then we can go into the general questions. Does that make sense?
That would be great. Commissioner Sam, thank you. I know you have a lot on your plate, so thank you. Just want you to depart when you need to. So thank you very much. And I appreciate your office being available to the municipal officials as they review the guidance and have their questions. They will have someone that they can speak with in your office. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to answer any questions later on.
Thank you. Dr. Brown, are you?
Yes, good morning.
Excellent.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate this morning. I believe this is the first time that I'm participating in this call during the pandemic. But in my role at the Department of Public Health, obviously, we've been working very, very closely with your local boards of health. And I just want to take a quick opportunity to thank all of you for everything that you are doing, have been doing, and will continue to do. I think we are very aware, I am very aware that from the department that, you know, we put together a lot of guidance and put it out, but then, you know, most of the actual hard work and implementation falls on all of you. And so we really appreciate your partnership during all of this. So my name's a little easier to pronounce than Commissioner Sam. So Dr. Catherine Brown, I think some of you probably know me as Katie. And so I just want to talk very briefly. The department has been working hard with the COVID Command Center and the Secretary Sutter's to put out data from about the impact of the pandemic on our residents in the Commonwealth. And we're working hard to put out data, not only to be transparent, but also, you know, that is useful to all of us that we will then use to help guide next steps. And so last week, we actually started with a new report. So we had been putting out the number of cases of COVID-19 by residents, city or town residents, as well as what we call a population adjusted rate. So, you know, how does that number of cases translate if we're going to set it as, you know, per 100,000 people? And we've been putting that out weekly, very regularly. But then, you know, one of the things that I think is important to understand is that the number of cases that are identified in a particular municipality is really also dependent on the amount of testing that's happening within that municipality. And so in an effort to sort of help provide more of the context behind those case numbers, last week we added the total number of residents in the municipality that were actually have been tested for COVID using the PCR molecular test. This is not using antibody tests, which are, you know, a whole different ballgame and are not useful for diagnostics in this moment. We've also included the rate, again, a population adjusted rate for total persons tested, and then the percent positivity. And so this is really the number of residents that tested positive out of the total number that were tested. So the reason that we think this is important is, one, it really does help to provide that context for, are you seeing a large number of cases in your community because you've actually, not you, but because there's been a lot of testing within the residents of that community, or is there potentially an indication of, you know, a hotspot? Those are all things that we all need to know and pay attention to. on the other hand, I also want people to understand that, you know, we're not looking at the percent positivity every day and going, oh my gosh, you know, one town is at almost 0% and one's at 20%. You know, we anticipate that as this pandemic continues, that we're going to see changes in kind of where those hotspots are. I think the most important piece that we should take away, and by we, I mean all of us, including those of us at the state level. The piece that we should take away is that there is still a need for us to be able to expand access to testing sites across the state, because you know, we can see from this that there are clearly communities where, you know, less testing has occurred. And when I look at where testing sites are, it's very clear to me that some of it is being driven by access. And so this is to help inform all of us as we think about how to continue to monitor the activity of COVID-19 across the Commonwealth. These data help us improve that access to testing, which will in turn improve our ability to monitor what's happening with COVID-19. And so I hope that context is helpful and help explain why we put these data out. And if there are any questions, I'm absolutely happy to take them. It does look like there's one quick question for me, which is the data that I'm discussing available to the public via an online link? And the answer is yes. This is data that are publicly posted on Wednesdays on the mass.gov website. It's posted with our what we call our dashboard data. So if you go to the mass.gov COVID website, it's one of the top links, and you can get directly to the data.
Thank you. Yes, and it's also linked from the daily situation reports, and there are many ways that people can find a way to navigate to the dashboard. But Wednesdays is when that material is refreshed on a municipality basis. We have another question for you, Dr. Brown. Has there been thought given to encouraging people to get tests? Essentially just encouraging people to go out and get testing as opposed to waiting until they have symptoms and so on. Can you update on that?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And we have seen recently sort of a drop off as it looks like has been seen in Brockton. We've seen this drop off in people seeking access to testing. You know, I think I'll say a couple things about that. One is that this is expected based on what we have seen in terms of reduced transmission of COVID. So it's not simply that people are not getting tested and we're not identifying cases. We really, because of all the social distancing measures, the stay at home, all of the hard work that we've all done, we did actually bend the curve. And so we are right now in this moment reaping the benefits of that, right? We have seen this decline in the number of cases. And so the decline in the number of people requesting testing follows that, right? There are fewer people getting sick right now, and so fewer people need to get tested. However, I very much hope that everybody is aware of the guidance that indicates that anyone who is identified as a close contact of someone with COVID is also recommended for testing, even if they don't have any symptoms. And that is really, I think, an important part of monitoring what is happening with COVID. That is guidance that sounds like maybe we need to, you know, continue to push out and remind people about. But that's certainly part of our testing plan in the Commonwealth. And again, as we move forward and as we look at patterns of disease and also patterns of test seeking, you know, this healthcare seeking behavior, we will adapt our recommendations as we need to make sure that we're getting all the data we need to track what's happening. But I thank you for that question.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And if hopefully you'll be able to stay around for a little while in case other questions directly related to you pop up. They may have, but let me see. I'll scroll down on the chat.
Do you want to speak to nursing homes and your approach to testing in that area?
Yes, of course. So, you know, I think everybody knows all too well that long-term care facilities have been hit particularly hard during this pandemic. It really has just been one of the tragedies that we have seen. But, you know, as a state, we have also been, I think, very aggressive about testing in long-term care facilities so that we could identify where COVID had been introduced, where it was impacting the population, which enabled the staff in those nursing homes, long-term care facilities to be able to institute appropriate infection control measures to try to stop spread. You know, COVID is really contagious. And, you know, unfortunately, when it has gotten into a long-term care facility, it is hard to stop. But the very aggressive testing program that was instituted in partnership with the COVID Command Center really, and, you know, working through the Massachusetts National Guard has really been, I think, instrumental in identifying what's happening, what has happened in our long-term care facilities. And then there are some recommendations from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare that are supporting sort of ongoing testing in those high-risk environments. And we're, you know, talking about ways that we can help support that. So we're continuing to work to protect some of our most vulnerable populations. You know, I do want to say that as transmission has decreased in the community, we have also seen a decrease in the impact in long-term care facilities. That is, you know, this is happening sort of across the board, but this has been a particularly hard hit area. And I just want to reassure everyone that, you know, these populations are going to continue. Sorry, this is not reassuring, that these populations are going to continue to be high risk and very vulnerable. But to reassure everyone that we're all going to work together to do what we need to do to help protect them.
Wow. Thank you. And Dr. Brown, just a question also from an official in Western Mass who has a CVS testing site that's opened up, and they're looking for reassurance that those test results are being shared with the Department of Public Health, and then that information is shared down the chain to the local boards of health.
Always appreciate those questions, because getting information from testing sites is extraordinarily critical to all of the control measures that need to be put in place. And so we have been working, so CVS has had other testing sites in Massachusetts already. We have been working very closely with them, and they have been providing good, solid information from those testing sites, and we've been sharing those down to the local boards of health promptly. It's an electronic process, and you know, I as soon as these new testing sites recently opened with CVS, I sent that information to our electronic laboratory reporting folks, and they are making sure that all of this is happening the way it's supposed to. So thanks for that question.
Thank you. And it's good to get reassurance in an uncertain world. There are a number of questions, Lieutenant Governor, that some of them are a little bit newer than regarding the reopening process and the impact on municipalities than the questions we received the last couple of weeks. So I'm thinking maybe we can address those and then go dive into the ones that have been asked before, but folks are looking for a little more clarity. Does that make sense?
Happy to. Thank you, Dr. Brown, for joining us this morning. We appreciate your insight and the role of testing as we move forward and reopen and also fight the virus spread. Thank you.
Yes. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
The first question that is new-ish has to do with municipal employees, especially those who are work out of state, and then hearing about the travel requirements and the requirement to quarantine for 14 days crossing the state border and so on. Just a little more information about the is requested regarding that. If someone in Massachusetts has an employee who is in New Hampshire, or has family in New Hampshire and goes up and visits the family over the weekend, there's a lot of confusion about whether or not then those individuals can go back to work or have to quarantine.
Let me just speak to the travel guidance as part of the reopening plan and the phased approach. In this phase one, it's a safer at home advisory. In phase two, that advisory changes to business and recreational travel discouraged. It does continue the urging to self-quarantine for 14 days for all travelers. Although if you live outside of Massachusetts and work in Massachusetts, you are exempt from that. But it is, again, an urging, and it would be self-compliance. And in particular, if you are a hotel operator and you're taking reservations from someone who is out of state in terms of their residency, the hotel operator's responsibility is to tell the person making the reservation what the Massachusetts travel guidance is relative to the urged self-quarantine. But they do not need to enforce that or police that in any way. It is the responsibility of the operator is to inform.
That's very helpful. And the specific exemption for the municipal employee lives out of state.
What a lot of other states are doing as well. I think we're all, as state leaders and municipal leaders, especially if you have a border community, they're just trying to reduce the in and outflow and the spread of the virus. So it's just one more tool to work with in order to address that. So common sense prevails, making good decisions, understanding the overall social guidance is around distancing, face coverings, hygiene, which are the critical weapons to slow the spread of the virus.
Absolutely. Thank you. A question about indoor dining. Is that going to, that's later in, at some point, potentially in phase two, depending on the health data. Is that correct?
That's correct. We have laid out the protocol so restaurants can begin to organize both for outdoor dining and indoor dining, but the indoor service at a table setup will be after a reasonable period of time following the outdoor dining. That could be a couple of weeks, but it will be within phase two. It'll be a sufficient amount of time for us to evaluate the data with the public health officials to determine that it's okay to begin the indoor seating. Now, a lot of people are asking, I think, about capacity. The way we've organized the industry protocol is not on capacity, but rather on 6-foot distances between tables. That's both for indoor and outdoor, 6 feet of distance between tables. The limit of 6 people to a table for a seating, and there is no bar seating or bar service, so no bartender serving over the bar to a customer seated at the bar. That is restricted. However, the bar square footage area can be reconfigured with tabletop capacity for seating. So in other words, you could take a high top and have it near your bar area and seat 4 to 6 people at that table, but they're not getting served over the bar or on a shared surface, which is what a bar usually is. And there is opportunity for the bartender to still access the tools and equipment within the bar area for mixing beverages for customers. There's also in the restaurant protocol and the executive order that we issued yesterday, some specific guidance and authority given to local officials around how to organize outdoor dining and using the outdoor spaces in your community for that purpose. It gives you a lot of authority and latitude and also collapses the usual 3-step ABCC process for on-premises consumption to a single step that is local only. So I think you will have a lot of tools to work with in order to design, support your restaurants and organize an outdoor dining experience. It also includes, coverings. So it could be an awning, it could be a tent as long as there's an openness in terms of the vertical areas around that space so that there's airflow. That can also be built into the outdoor dining program in addition to umbrellas and other ways to deal with elements in the weather that could impact that kind of experience. I'm hearing from a lot of restaurants that they're excited to get it started. You're seeing from other states too some really interesting opportunities to bring people together to support the restaurants and enjoy the season, fortunately, that we're in with warmer weather.
Yes, and thank you. And thank you. There are a number of comments in the chat expressing appreciation for the creativity and the flexibility in the executive order for communities and recognizing the need to for speed and communities to be able to set, work with their restaurant community as quickly and as innovatively as possible. We would recommend, the MMA would recognize, recommend that communities review the executive order with their legal counsel to just clarify the steps that they can take in the process. MMA will not be providing legal guidance to communities on this regard just because of the variance in ordinances and bylaws. But there have been questions about the order adopting the process, allowing the unilaterally granting outdoor dining for restaurants without approvals from planning boards and so on. That's the intent, is to centralize the decision making during this this period of time. Communities will want to review that with their legal counsel as well, just to make sure that everyone's on the same page locally in their interpretation. There's a question about window service and food and for food and beverage being permissible. I mean, that's is that envisioned, or has that been something that sort of like in curbside that you've envisioned already being allowable, Lieutenant Governor?
Right, curbside takeout, obviously ongoing. The purpose of the protocol specifically wants to see table service. So not standing close together at a bar or perhaps even a window, unless the window service was available for a single pickup with the 6-foot distancing between people standing in line, something like that might be able to be organized. But it really is for table seating. And it does address the 6-foot distances between tables as well as the customer coming into the establishment, whether outdoor or indoor, with face covering, seated, then becoming seated, and then while seated, can remove the face covering. The workforce, however, does need to move around the establishment and will be wearing a face covering during that work.
Thank you very much. I know we only have about 5 or 6 minutes left. I wanted to cover a few more. There were some questions about town halls opening. Of course, you're not requiring town halls or city halls to open for the public entry. Yet that's envisioned right now in this phase for essential services and in phase two for sort of general operations if communities wish and they follow all of the guidelines. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that was a question that did come up last week as well. The 25% capacity limit is there, but the capacity limit is based on maximum building occupancy level specified, or the typical occupancy as of March 1, 2020. There's also flexibility for municipalities because you may deem a number of your services as essential, which was the case from the beginning of COVID. So a number of town halls and city halls remained open because of the essential nature of the service that you provide. And I think that's really where it's at. I think in terms of other buildings, like libraries, senior centers, DCAM is designing guidance for state public buildings, and we're supposed to be sharing that with you very soon to help you make decisions relative to those kinds of facilities that are more of an outward customer-facing opportunity for seniors, for programming, for families coming in and out of a library. So you might want to take a look at that guidance when it's issued and to make decisions from there. There was also a question last time about, can municipalities refuse entry to buildings for those who refuse to comply with wearing a face covering for a non-medical reason? You can, but not for voting. Voting, we would not advise you to interfere with a citizen's right to vote.
Yes, that is sort of a progression there to that communities can, especially in this day, because of your executive order that allows for remote participation in public meetings and so on. If someone does not want to wear a face mask for their own personal reasons, they can not wear a face mask at home, so safe distance, and watch on Zoom or some other event, the local meeting that's taking place. But election is another story. So we appreciate that clarification very much. There's a question about whether or not you envision in future phases the increasing that capacity level for office spaces from the 25% and so on. Do you envision changing that for phase two, I guess, because we likely would have heard that, but for phase three?
That's under consideration for phase three. The 25% capacity again is set for offices. Municipalities have more flexibility because you have an essential service that you offer. We'll just have to monitor that and see what we arrive at in phase three. There was also a question about some of the rationale behind why certain activities and businesses are in phase two or phase three or phase four. There was a question around museums, some of the indoor-outdoor aspects of sort of entertainment, cultural, museum kinds of opportunities. Just want to flag that because we do have a work group that addressed restaurants, lodging, and tourism. And that tourism piece, we are continuing our dialogue with people, for instance, from the Berkshires and the Cape and the Islands that have a season ahead of them. It's really important to their overall economy. And looking at the kinds of attractions that might be ready to open sooner than phase three under certain capacity restrictions and safety protocols. So we are looking at that, and it's possible that some of those categories that you see currently in phase three could advance to later on in phase two.
Very good. And then I'm scrolling up because we've hit most of the newer questions. There's a early on question about the office rule, maximum flexibility for cities and towns. If you have a question, you can contact in my upper right-hand screen, Director Michael Flanagan, right, from the other DLS. Because there is a whole series of progressions for communities in terms of flexibility, but there's no requirement that communities open to the public at any one of these stages during the emergency. So communities have flexibility. And also at all times, even with these conditions, just to be clear, if they want to have a greater than 25% capacity because of the service being essential, the communities still need to abide by the health and safety standards of the safe distancing, the facial covering, the training, and the hygiene. So it's important that that's not an exemption from any of those requirements as well. So,
that's right.
Lieutenant Governor, we've come up on the hour. We will, as always, forward any of these unasked questions to your team and then publish the responses. Again, want to express our appreciation for everything that you're doing. There's so much here. It is like the Amazon River flowing down, and just trying to share all of this information with communities is, we appreciate how much you're doing and how challenging it is for our own members. So we'll continue to try and get as much information out as possible and work and collaborate with you. Do you have any final words for all of the local officials who are with us this morning?
Is that there will be more guidances coming out this week. So I appreciate, Jeff, you are distributing those as we release them to the members. So you don't have to go search for them on the COVID website. And also, I found that this conversation this morning with the commissioner and Dr. Brown being specific about, you know, conversation about a specific topic was helpful. And if there is a topic for next week that you'd like to incorporate into our hour together, happy to organize that. I think that makes some sense, so we can give you a little bit more detail to work with. And just overall, just thank you, and to your staffs at your city halls and town halls, your Parks and Rec, your DPW, your law enforcement, everyone. Just thank you for what you're doing. It's an honor to be able to partner with you. We couldn't do this without you. And thank you, and we look forward to addressing whatever other concerns that come up during the course of the week in our time together next week. We look forward to.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor, and to all the local officials who've joined, and to Commissioner Sam and Dr. Brown and all of the participants from the administration. Today, you have been viewing the 11th weekly COVID-19 briefing from Municipal Chief Executive Officers. Next week, we'll meet again on Tuesday. An invitation will go out to everyone at the end of this week, and we'll continue to push out and share all of these this information, these guidances to the administration. We thank you so much, and we look forward to working with you and seeing you again.
Thank you all. Have a good day.
Thank you.